I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. In Gish Jen's new novel, Bad Bad Girl, she imagines her mother's life through a fictional account of her upbringing in China in the 1930s, all the way up to her death in America in 2020. But the novel transforms into more of a nonfiction account of her life once Jen recalls her own memories of her mother, a complicated project due to her mother's abuse and withholding of love. Nevertheless, Gish Jen creates a well-rounded and at times empathetic character whose voice she still hears. I recently spoke with Gish Jen about Bad Bad Girl, and here's our conversation.
My name is Gish Jen, and I have written a novel entitled Bad Bad Girl. And yes, I am the Bad Bad Girl in the title. Although there's another Bad Bad Girl as well, as
exactly,
we'll get into.
Exactly. And I do have a question about that later. But can you give our listeners a description of Bad Bad Girl? Because, you know, help us understand the nuance of the genre. I mean, it's labeled a novel. But in your author's note at the beginning of the book, you say that this book is a novel and there might be some truth to it.
Yeah, well, you know, like many novels, right, it grows out of some truth. I mean, I think there's no real rule for this, but some are totally imagined, but many have some kind of basis in truth. And the amount that they draw on reality varies a lot. In this case, you know, I use quite a lot of reality, but it is still a novel. It is shaped. There are whole characters that are added. The letters have definitely been monkeyed with in such a way as to suit the narrative. And most importantly of all, it's written in a way to really convey the emotional truth of my experience and my mother's experience. So when people ask me, well, why did you fictionalize? So I started, you know, this book is in a memoir. And one of the opening incidents, which is, you know, my mother, in real life, this did happen, that my mother did have her nursemaid kind of just wrenched from her when she was seven, and just one day just gone. And, you know, that was the most upsetting thing that happened to her in her entire life. And I have told that story to my children, and they kind of go, oh, that's too bad, you know. But when I fictionalized it, they cried. And that's what I'm doing. So, you know, so I'm trying to give full weight to these experiences and make them real and involve the reader in a way that does justice to the material.
You know, when I was coming up with my questions, I was very careful to respect the fact that this was labeled a novel by referring to, you know, the quote unquote, the narrator who actually shares your name in the book instead of you. But, you know, if I slip up, please forgive me, because I do have to remind myself that some of these things are fiction, especially if I slip up at a part that is absolutely fictionalized. So I want to talk a bit about mothers and daughters, because there are two mother-daughter relationships we follow throughout. In the first section of the book, the narrator imagines her mother's life growing up, partially from what she's been told, in some of the letters and date books that the mother left behind, partially from her imagination. And it does make the reader empathetic to her experience, particularly her relationship with her own mother. Can you talk a little bit about this often fraught relationship between, I guess it would be your mother and your grandmother?
Yeah, so let me just sort of say, from the point of view of whether this is fiction or nonfiction, I never met my grandmother once, right? She died before I ever got to China. I never met her. And so I only know her filtered through my mother, who never really talked about her, you know, so I know very little. And so pretty much, you know, any scene that, you know, that where you see my, you know, the person who's quote unquote my, the narrator's grandmother, that person is totally fictional, right? It's totally, as is, you know, the figure of my quote unquote grandfather, right? These figures are totally fictionalized. Like I say, they have some basis in truth, but really they're fiction. And their relationship is entirely inferred, right? You know, I noticed growing up that my real mother never talked about her mother, and she never talked about her mother like there were no stories, you know. She never said something like, oh yeah, you know, I came home from school and I had something terrible happened and my mother said to me, you know, don't worry about it, X, Y, and Z, you know, some pearl of wisdom. There were no stories like that. And I noticed that. And I noticed that, you know, she mostly talked about how beautiful her mother was. And my own mother was very normal looking, but she was definitely not one of these, you know, beautiful Chinese gorgeous women. You know, there are many of them. And my mother was not one of them. And so it was very striking that she's always talking about how her mother was one of them. So, you know, I picked up a lot about their relationship from these things. But everything in the book is made up. But, you know, one could infer, you know, one can infer. And of course, I could very much infer what kinds of things were said to her by the kinds of things she said to me, and that this is from life. And, you know, looking back at it, it's so weird. You know, it's, I mean, like, I can't really imagine with my own children, I can't imagine telling a daughter every day that no one would ever marry her. You know, I can't imagine marriage kind of figuring so large in the mother's conception of her daughter. Like, you know, she's almost like, you know, she's only looked at as a prospective bride. And I realized that, oh, my mother said those things all the time to me because they had been said to her and she had been looked at in just that way.
And is that where the title comes in?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, in that kind of framework, it's not hard to be really bad. You know? And also, you know, my mother, because my real mother had grown up in 1930s, you know, which is pre-revolutionary China. You know, that is a China where there are very, very narrow ideas about what a woman should be doing. And you know, of course, you know, we have many accounts of the women who broke free, but those are very, very unusual people. And you know, the vast majority of women, you know, were, it was tough. I mean, there were very few things that they were allowed to do. And there was my mother, who was very high-spirited and very smart. And of course, she would be thought of as a bad, bad girl because those are not the qualities that one is looking for in a prospective bride for one's son. One is looking for somebody who is going to take care of the mother-in-law, who is going to ask her how she likes her soup, you know? You know, I mean, literally, because the daughter-in-law is really often a kind of servant, really, to the family and certainly to her husband. And so they're really looking for all the servant qualities. And if you don't evince those qualities, you are bad.
Well, in addition to bad, bad girl being scolding used throughout, another idea often repeated was, too bad you're a girl.
Yeah. And, you know, that's because that was true of both my mother and me, because there was this real sense like, wow, you know, we could, if only. You know, we could take your brains and your spirit and put them in a boy. That would have been perfect, you know? And, you know, I think that in my real mother's case, you know, and also in the mother in the book, there was, you know, it was a backhanded compliment, right? I mean, because it was a way of saying, like, wow, we can see you actually have some wonderful things about you. But it was very backhanded. So it was, if we could see there's some wonderful things about you, boy, it's too bad you weren't a boy. Oh, I can laugh, but truly, this is not a way to bring up children.
Let's talk about Agnes, your mother, and the fictional character. She immigrated to the United States, and I think it was our narrator who said to her mother, "You were an English-speaking, Chinese-thinking person." And one of the characters, Mrs. Cunningham, described Agnes as only half here, suggesting that her body was in America, but her soul was in China. Did you feel that as well?
Yeah, I think that Mrs. Cunningham is almost entirely fictional. She's based on there was a wonderful woman who lived in the Dead End when I was growing up, but she never said any of those things. So every line of dialogue is made up, and that observation is made up. And of course, in the back and forth with my mother, that's all imagined because my mother is I'm talking to a dead person, and she, you know, she doesn't say anything because she's dead, actually, in real life. But I do think that finally, you know, my mother was very Chinese and she embraced a lot of American things. She loved lobster, she loved baseball, and you know, she It's not like in the New York Times. She loved the New York Times. But fundamentally, a lot of her thinking was old world. And, she did come, she was already in her 20s, and, meaning she wasn't 6 or 7 or 8. And a lot of her ideas were old world. And also, she didn't have a lot of contact with other people in America. She knew people, but she didn't have a lot of close friends. And I think that that really affected the degree to which she actually assimilated.
So the narrator and her mother, you and your mother, were very different people, but shared some similarities, particularly when it came to your relationship with family, love of literature. And assuming these characters represent some parts of you and your mother, are there similarities between the two of you that you were surprised to learn about when writing this book?
The thing that I was most surprised about as I researched this book and started to write was how self-sacrificing my mother was and how much she actually gave. So on the surface, she was really pretty tough, right? And she didn't give all the kinds of things we in America think that a mother is supposed to be giving, kind of reflecting you in some kind of positive light so that you would think well of yourself. And have self-confidence and that kind of thing. She did not do any of that. She did quite the opposite, really. But on the other hand, underneath it, she did things for the family that are not a lot of people would. And the things that for her were unbelievably difficult. And I'm thinking particularly of her teaching in this inner city school. It was extremely rough. It would have been rough for anyone. And somebody from her background was obviously completely unprepared to take on that job. And she did it uncomplainingly, like she never told us. And that really struck me about her. And I had to take my hat off to her. I mean, I was just very touched. And, she did it for our tuition. And there was a way in which she might have couched that as duty, rather, it's not a gift to us. It's simply what she's supposed to do. And so she did it. And I think there's a certain amount of that in me too. Do you know what I mean? I mean, whether it's tuition or other things, certainly there is a way in which I also have a feeling of obligation to my children. I will literally do anything, and I would never tell them. And I don't see it as a gift. I just see it as my job, I guess. And so I guess I did inherit that from my mother. And that's very Chinese, you know? It's like no student loans, You just pay your children's tuition, period.
I was struck by your incredible capacity for forgiveness. Both of your parents were sometimes violent with you, yet you treated them with dignity and respect throughout the rest of their lives. Was forgiveness something you ever struggled with, or did it just come naturally for you?
No, it was hard to get to a point where I could forgive my mother, especially. It's easy for with my father, because my father was prone to, he did some very bad things, including beating me up. That's not okay, but he really loved me, and I got that, and I got it also that it was part of his cultural vocabulary, that beating in China, they used to say, if you don't beat and scold, the child is not your child. It's part of how they parent. I mean, I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying that it's a cultural difference. It was much, much harder for me to get to the point where I could forgive my mother. But I got there. I did get there. But I can't say that it was easy. No, it was hard.
You mentioned this earlier, but throughout the book, there are interstitial sections in which you imagine what your mother would be saying right now about what you have written and what she is reading that you have written. Where did this idea come from? And does her voice still appear clearly to you after writing the book?
I think many people hear, the voices of their dead parents or their dead friends. I don't think that I'm alone. I think a lot of us, yeah, we can still hear what so and so would say if they were with us. And in fact, in an earlier novel, I had a novel called World in Town. There's a woman who loses her best friend, and she can hear her best friend all the time, So I don't think that's so unusual. It's a little more unusual in this book because I talk so much to my mother. And that grew out, it grew just as I kind of suggest in the, as this book, as I said, sort of shades from fiction to nonfiction. And in the last section, which is, which is quite nonfictional, there's very little fiction in it. But in that last section, you can see me starting to write to my mother, after she's died. And you can see me addressing her, in my just these jottings. And I'm sure that's where this voice came from, the idea of talking to her and having her talk back. You can see me addressing her, and then you could see the moment where I can hear her talking back to me. And that kind of just grew very naturally into this ex larger exchange that you see throughout the book.
This quote stuck with me. Somehow, after all, thanks to the love of my father, my husband, my children, and my friends, as well as, I'm sure, to the power of reading and writing, I have thrived. She has hurt but not destroyed me. Indeed, she has perhaps fueled me. And then later, I'm trying to remember the context, if this was a conversation with your mother or not. But she said, "You should thank writing, of course," she says. "Writing, your other mother, writing."
Writing is a gift, which is really, not very well understood, I think. But I mean, like, well, therapists will tell you that. Therapists will say, well, why don't you write about it? There's something about, writing, going through something slowly and really, and thinking slowly through a whole narrative, which is just very healing, I think, because it gives you perspective on yourself. So you do become, you start out as Gishtchen the daughter, but you end Gishtchen the author. So, the daughter might be something like, I can't believe my mother, da 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 da. But the author says, wow, there was a cultural revolution going on. And, that might have had something to do with, the pressures on your mother and why she reacted the way she did. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that writing brings you to this other place of greater perspective and therefore greater empathy, And so I think writing has helped me. And I mean, I don't only write for therapy, obviously. It's a kind of a byproduct of what I ended up doing. But I do recommend it to everyone, honestly. I mean, I just think that, anyone who's had a very difficult relationship or has had a very difficult experience, I think to sit down and write about it is kind of a great first step to actually being able to integrate it in some helpful way and move on.
Your author's note at the beginning of the book begins with this quote, "You never wrote about your mother. So why was this the time for you to write this book?"
Because my mother had died. I mean, my mother died during COVID, and I was so overwhelmed by grief that I think that if I didn't write about my mother, I probably would have just sat there doing nothing for the next 5 years. So yeah, it was when my mother died, and I was trying to get to the bottom of something. I was trying to understand her. It's like, I was trying to understand, why was she this way? Do you know what I mean? Why? She's so smart. She could have changed, changed tack at any point. Why didn't she change? So, and that's what drove me to the page.
I typically ask authors if they have a hope for what readers will take away from the book. This feels like it's more for you.
Of course, this is for readers in the end. I mean, in the end, I started the book writing it for myself, but it ended as a novel, right? So why did I make up all those sections? Why did I make it so that the narrative worked? Why did I make the letters all work so that you could understand the historical context? That is for the reader. In the end, I'm a storyteller. I'm telling a story. I'm not delivering a message. But as to what readers might gain from that, I would hope that they would gain increased compassion. I think that I have a lot of compassion for my mother. I hope that the reader will also have a lot of compassion for my mother. And I hope that just as that was a stretch for me, that will be a stretch for them. And that I hope that they will be surprised at how much compassion they can feel for somebody that they may, on the surface of it think is wrong, 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 and bad, bad, bad. but I hope that by the end, yeah, they'll come to a place of deeper understanding, not just for my mother, but for others.
Well, the book is Bad, Bad Girl. Gish Jen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
Bad, Bad Girl by Gish Jen was published by Knopf. Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a new novel that blends ancient history with modern forensics.
Anna North's new novel opens in a bog in northwest England, where crews dig up a body and believe they have solved a cold case. 30 years ago, a local man killed his wife and threw her into the bog to hide the evidence, or so he confessed, and police summon a forensic anthropologist to investigate. But when our main character, Agnes, arrives at the scene, she discovers that the spongy marsh hides a much older mystery. The body from the bog is more than 2,000 years old, dating all the way back to the dawn of the Roman Empire. The remains are surprisingly well preserved, almost beautiful. And it's up to the forensic bone specialist to figure out how she died and possibly how she lived. Bog Queen is North's fourth novel, and a far cry from the Wild West of Outlawed or her post-apocalyptic America Pacifica. The setting here is very much a character, as North devotes occasional chapters to the collective voice of a moss colony that inhabits the bog. "I think you should take a longer view on things," the ancient colony explains. "Yes, you found a body here, but is the body really what's important? Or is it the conversation the body opens up about the earth, the past, the future? Is that what really matters?" As Agnes struggles to decipher the mystery of the woman in the bog, she gets caught up in a battle between developers and a group of activists trying to preserve the bog. She also is forced to question her professional expertise, her personal strength, and her place in the world. An alternating timeline takes us back to the Iron Age and the voice of the bog woman herself, a Celtic priestess who was the Druid of Bereda, who struggles to navigate her spiritual and diplomatic duties. The result is a complex and beautifully written story that explores female power and leadership across time, as well as environmental concerns. It also meshes past and present in surprising ways, illustrating the connections between humans and nature and our evolving belief systems. Bog Queen offers everything fans love about historical fiction, a fascinating look back through time with memorable characters, remarkable settings, and a story that moves along at a steady clip. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Bog Queen by Anna North was published by Bloomsbury. And now joining us with some book recommendations is Elizabeth Plumley Watson of Loganberry Books in Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is across the street from Cleveland. Welcome to Marginalia, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much, Beth. Thanks for having me.
So what books do you have for us today?
Well, the first book that I have, I'm so excited that you're talking about Bog Queen, because that's a forthcoming book that I'm excited about. But a very favorite book of mine from the past year, the one that really sticks out to me that I've hand sold so many times that I know I'm going to keep hand selling for years, is The Bog Wife by Kay Chronister. It is set in the hills of West Virginia. And it is a family saga. It is a grown siblings come back together kind of family saga, which tends to not be my kind of thing. A lot of people love them. I don't know what my deal is with family stories and grown siblings bring their dysfunctions back to the dinner table together. Doesn't normally tend to be my thing. But this book has such incredible atmosphere to it. It is about these five siblings who were raised in great isolation by a really controlling father who told them that their family basically sprang from the bog that they are caretakers of, this mountain bog, a mountain bog in West Virginia, and that the mother of each successive generation is actually born from the bog. She is a bog queen. She is a bog body, so to speak. And the siblings are grown now. The father is dying. They all have different takes on what this means. The wonderful thing, I think, about this book, aside from the atmosphere and the beautiful language, is that Chronister really makes you start to wonder if the legend is true, because the siblings are wondering that. But she does this incredible switch around. For me, it happened kind of midway through, where you realize what the real myth is. And it's an incredible book about Appalachia, about families, about eco-horror, sort of like, what is my body? What is the earth's body? What's the difference between those things? Is there a difference between those things? I love it. I'm going to keep thinking about it for years to come.
Very cool.
And then another, I'm a huge fan of backlist. If you come to me in Loganberry and say, like, what's the best new book that everyone's excited about? I might catch you off guard by saying, well, wouldn't you rather know what incredible book people aren't excited about right now, but they were, you know, 25 years ago and that you missed? That's why you come to me, a bookseller, not just the internet. And a book that I like to recommend in connection with The Bog Wife, sort of this chthonic feel, you know, this of the earth spookiness, is The Girls by John Donovan, which is a queer rom-com. It is a ghost story. It's a murder mystery in 1970s England with this lesbian couple who are kind of trying to live off grid and start a family, and everything goes horribly wrong. Or does it go horribly right? That is what is there for the the reader to find out. And then just to sort of pivot a little bit, I noticed such an uptick of real interest in philosophy from readers right now. People coming in who maybe haven't read philosophy in the past, but they kind of feel overwhelmed looking at the philosophy wall and wondering, where do I start? Feels heady, but feels like a time when I have big questions, but the answers maybe feel too big. And one that I've sold almost 200 copies of,
wow,
is called Eros the Bittersweet by Anne Carson. Anne Carson, you might know as one of the greatest living poets in the English language, I would contend, one of the greatest living translators from ancient Greek. She's a classicist, she's a Canadian classicist. But this particular book, Eros the Bittersweet, not super long, is her exploring Plato's teachings on what does it mean to be in love, and what happens when we're in love, but also what is a metaphor. And she sort of takes these little like tidbits of Plato and she cracks them open. My best friend gave it to me for my 18th birthday 20 years ago now, and it changed my life. And I've read it many times, and I think it is one of those life-changing books. And then I don't know if I'm on my last one, maybe a last book I'll give you. Our store has a wonderful children's book section, but I'm not a children's book specialist. You know, I'm a bookseller, so I can always recommend you a book. But my favorite picture book of this year is Rosemary Long Ears by Susie Garamani. And it is about a basset hound with, you guessed it, supernaturally long ears. Like, you thought basset hounds had long ears to begin with. Rosemary is something else. Rosemary's ears defy description. And Rosemary Long Ears is just about a day that Rosemary spends with her friend, who's a human child going around the neighborhood, going on adventures. The ears get them into all kinds of scrapes, but they also make them lots of friends. And the illustrations are just, I've looked through this book like 25 times, and it makes me laugh with delight every time. I love Rosemary. I think everyone else will love Rosemary too.
Well, very good. You can find a list of Elizabeth's book recommendations on our website at kmuw.org. Thanks so much for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Luann Stevens, and Carly Cooper. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.